From NPR and WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix, Arizona. This is Here and Now. Two doctors in Israel have contracted the Omicron variant of COVID-19. Both had been vaccinated and boosted, according to the Sheba Medical Center. Omicron is a variant with upwards of 50 mutations, and it has put countries around the world on alert in the week since it was first detected. It's been found on five continents and poses a very high risk, according to the World Health Organization.
And yet a lot is still not known, including whether it makes people sicker, whether it will respond to the current vaccines, and how widespread it really is. Let's bring in Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
Glad to have you. And I want to start with some basic questions, since Omicron is still only been with us for about a week that we know of. I mean, how concerned should people be? We haven't seen it in the U.S. yet, we should note, and yet epidemiologists are pretty sure it is already here.
Yeah. So, you know, about every month, 6 weeks, we hear about a new variant. And most of them, I think we can rightly dismiss as not being particularly significant. This one is different. It is concerning to me. It's concerning, obviously, to lots of other people. And there are really two reasons. One is the speed with which it has taken off in South Africa and in other countries. And then all those mutations. Now, number of mutations isn't necessarily that important, but where the mutations are, particularly on the spike protein, the what's called the RBD, the receptor binding domain, that's the place our vaccines target. And so it really is concerning to us also about, you know, how well our vaccines are going to hold up against this variant.
I see. There's really so many different things to look at. I think maybe two that are really top of mind probably for a lot of folks is, one, is it more transmissible than the Delta variant that we're very much still dealing with? And then second, will it cause more severe illness? What do we know about those two things?
Yep. Those are two of the really key questions. So let's dispense with one very quickly, where we have no data at all on that severity of illness. Is this going to cause the same level of severity illness? Will it be milder disease, more severe disease? We have no idea at this point. We've heard anecdotes of few people saying that the few people who they knew had mild disease, it would be lovely if that turned out to be the case more broadly. We just don't know, and it'll take us a little while to sort that out. On the issue of transmissibility, the reason that I think it got everybody concerned initially was we saw the speed with which became dominant in one of the regions of South Africa in a place where Delta was already there, and that looked like it was outcompeting Delta. Delta is a very, very contagious variant. And so something that's even more contagious than Delta, I have to say, I think most of us weren't expecting. Now, just one place for it to take off, that doesn't necessarily mean it's more contagious. There are other explanations. Again, there's going to be more work on this. We're going to know more in the next week or two. But that is something that I think a lot of us are concerned about.
Doctor, I want to go back to those mutations. We know that a virus will frequently evolve if it's given the chance to replicate. But this variant, as we've described, has got nearly 50 of these mutations on the spike protein. Do you have any theories as to why it got this way, or why it looks this way and appears to be more complicated?
Yeah, so it's always difficult to sort of figure out exactly what were the selective pressures, the kind of evolutionary pressures that created this. The best theory right now is that you had somebody who is immunocompromised, who essentially became chronically ill with this virus, and then the virus mutated within that one person, really generating all of these mutations. When you look at things like the Alpha variant that initially came out of the UK last fall, it was a similar thing. It was somebody who had who was immunocompromised, got infected, had a long bout, and within that person, the virus had multiple mutations. That's what we think happened here. We don't know for sure. It's always hard to tell exactly why a virus generates the mutations that it does, but clearly if it generates those mutations and survives and replicates, that means it must have some sort of fitness advantage. It must give the virus an advantage that the previous one didn't have.
And regardless of why, we still need to look for it and find it now. So that means sequencing, which is looking at the actual virus after people test positive to figure out which variant is in fact making them sick and whether it's the Delta or the Omicron. Early in the pandemic, the U.S. had been criticized for not doing enough sequencing. What do the numbers look like now? Have we gotten any better at that? And how important will sequencing be in slowing down Omicron if we need to?
Yeah, so sequencing is enormously important, and we've gotten much, much better. I'd say if we were here a year ago, I would tell you that we were woefully far behind. We have a lot of capability, but we just weren't putting in the resources and energy to do this. The idea, as you said, is when you have a positive test, you want to take a sample of those and send them off to be sequenced to figure out exactly what variant it is. And there's a lot of discussion about what proportion do we need to be sequencing. A year ago, we were probably sequencing 1 in 1,000 samples, way too little. Now we're at about 2 to 3%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but actually generates a lot of sequences, and that's probably enough that we're going to be able to find Omicron pretty quickly. So we've gotten much, much better. Could we do a little more? Maybe. The UK does more like 5%, and they're really thought of as the gold standard. But I don't think sequencing is going to be our limitation the way it was maybe six or certainly a year ago.
And Dr. Jha, I mean, I think that sort of the next step question that a lot of folks are wondering about, too, is vaccines. What I already have in my arm, is that going to protect me? And I think that's something that the Moderna CEO, Stéphane Bancel, told the Financial Times has really caught a lot of people's attention. Moderna, of course, is one of the vaccine makers. And he says, quote, there is no world, I think, where the effectiveness is the same we had with the Delta variant. I think it's going to be a material drop. Now, I've realized there's more data to collect, but that's quite a statement from a person who's pretty plugged in. So what is that likelihood? Moderna is saying it could produce a new vaccine if it needed to within 2 or 3 months. But then there's the question of whether that new vaccine would also sort of provide reverse protection against the original or the Delta. What do we know about vaccines?
Yeah, there's a lot. This is obviously quickly moving. So let me tell you how I think about it right now. We don't know how much of a hit the vaccines are going to take in terms of effectiveness. I agree with the Moderna CEO that it will take a hit. The question is how much and for whom. My best estimate and the way I think about this is that if you're fully vaccinated and boosted, you're probably going to do okay. It will probably still give you a very high degree of protection and almost surely a very high degree of protection against severe illness. So maybe we'll see more breakthroughs, but we will not see a lot of people getting severely ill because a boosted person has a broad range of antibodies and has a lot of other parts of the immune system that has gotten trained against this virus. So that's one of the reasons why it's absolutely essential that anybody who's 5 to 6 months out from their second shot, absolutely, any adult, go get a booster. If you're not fully boosted, if you're not boosted, if you're just fully vaccinated and you're 6 months out, you already are seeing a hit on vaccine effectiveness against Delta. There probably will be a very large drop off against Omicron. Now, do I know that for sure? I don't. But that's what many of us are expecting. And one of the absolutely essential reasons why we need to go and get boosters right now is that.
Let me just jump in right there. Yeah, and I want you to make your last point, but this is really interesting to me because I just got my booster, my third shot, over the weekend as all of this news was unfolding. And I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, do I need to get this shot right now or should I wait a little bit to figure out if there's going to be some new formula? Like, will this booster be irrelevant? It sounds like you're saying very clearly, go get the booster.
Yes, no, it's exactly right. Exactly right. People should go get the booster because the booster will give you protection for a significant period of time. We don't know how long, and if Omicron really is more contagious, and let's say it does become dominant in the U.S., there is no question in my mind right now that a booster is much more protective than just being, let's say, fully vaccinated but not being boosted. On the question of whether you're going to need an Omicron-specific vaccine, we really don't know. Both Moderna and Pfizer, and J&J, by the way, are starting to work on those formulations, and they should. We don't have to wait for all the data to come in. We want to get going. I don't know if we'll need it, though, and we'll find out as the next few weeks come in. And if there is a need for one, yes, it'll take 3 months to produce it, but then we'll have to get it out to people. It may be a little while, and you want to be protected between now and then. And so there's no question in my mind that, I got boosted about 3-4 weeks ago. If I hadn't, I would be getting a booster today.
I see. So your advice is go get your booster. But in the moment we have left, what else should people do in practical terms? I mean, the president is saying, be cautious, but don't panic. So concretely, does that mean don't travel, wear masks indoors? What do you recommend?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, you should be doing what you were doing a week ago when we had this other very contagious variant, Delta, which is I have plans for the holidays. I think it's fine to keep them. I think people should know that there is a chance. Look, if this turns out to be on the kind of worst end of our expectations, then you may need to make changes. But I suspect that with the standard stuff that we know about this variant, and again, I always remind people, this is not a magical virus. It's the same virus, which still spreads the same ways. If people are careful, if people mask indoors, if people use testing when they don't feel well, if they're fully, you know, boosted, I think most of life can continue. And then we just have to see what the new data tells us. And if we need to adjust, we'll adjust.
Here's hoping. That's Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, thanks as always, and stay healthy.
Hey, thank you so much.
The golfer Lee Elder died this week at the age of 87. Back in 1975, Elder was the first black player to compete at the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. Elder was a groundbreaking athlete in a sport that was dominated by white players. Up until 1961, black people weren't even allowed in the PGA. Something similar was happening in tennis at around the same time. Only it was Arthur Ashe who was the protagonist of that story. Ashe is the only black man to win singles titles at Wimbledon, the U.S. and Australian Opens. In the new documentary, Citizen Ashe, he reflects on how stoicism helped him cope with racism.
Some people say that my notion or feelings of self-sufficiency go too far. I think I can almost withstand just about anything.
Ashe died in 1993. The new film explores how he used his fame to promote civil rights and later AIDS awareness. His brother, Johnny Ashe, joins me now. Johnny, it's good to talk to you.
Good talking to you.
And the world knew Arthur Ashe as a tennis great and then eventually as an activist. But what was he like as a boy?
He was my big brother. When daddy wasn't around, he was the enforcer. And I say that with a giggle because of his mild-mannered nature, but he knew what daddy expected of us, you know, and he, of course, helped me with homework, checking my vernacular and those, that type of thing, you know.
Sounds like a good brother. Now, you said that Arthur was the enforcer when your daddy wasn't around. Your dad was a tough, strict guy. You know, your mother died when Arthur was very young.
Daddy had a lot of respect for authority. And he realized us being born in the capital of the Confederacy, Richmond, Virginia, that things would be tough growing up to a certain degree because we were young Negro boys. And he had a set of values and he had a set of disciplines that he instilled in us. And quite frankly, I'm glad he did for both of our sakes, for Arthur's and mine, because, you know, those disciplines are where Arthur's lifestyle started, and it did me in good stead because of my career in the Marine Corps.
Well, people who are familiar with your brother's story may not actually know that you may have played a pretty important role advancing his tennis career, because it was you who volunteered to do a second tour of duty in Vietnam, and that meant that Arthur Ashe wouldn't go into combat. Tell me how you made that choice.
Well, the choice was simple. I didn't want that for my brother. He didn't need that. I had known from an early age that Arthur was more than just a tennis player. Tennis was a catalyst for him. You know, I knew that Arthur was going to make his mark in the world one way or the other.
Well, he may have had much more to give than what he could on the tennis court, but he was still a really good athlete. In 1968, he won the U.S. Open, and we have a taste of what that sounded like.
And he's got it!
He is still the only black man who has ever won that tournament, but what was it like to watch it happen as his brother?
Well, when it was over, all I could do is go to my room and, you know, give it a good fist bump and say, he did it. And, you know, that was honestly the last time I thought about the sacrifice that I made until you know, ESPN did 30-30. And he called me a little later that day, you know, and he said, I said, well, you did it. You're there now. He says, I'm a champion now and people will listen to me. What that told me was tennis was still a vehicle in his life. It wasn't the end all. And that, in my mind, justified everything that I did.
Well, you know, you're right. People did want to hear from him at that point, didn't they? Because shortly after he won, they invited him on to Face the Nation. Here's some of that.
If you happen to be black in these times, maybe not 30 years ago, but in these times, 1968, it's really a mandate that you do something. You must. And there are other athletes and other black leaders, period, who are using their positions of power and influence to wield some practical progress. So it's just simply saying to myself, Arthur, you must do something. You just cannot sit by and let the world go by.
So this is another really interesting thing about your brother. In the early days of his career, he chose not to get involved with the civil rights movement. And he wasn't speaking out like a lot of the other professional black athletes were at the time. Tell me about that and why you think he made those choices.
Because he wasn't ready. If you listen to his answers, you would realize that he had taken some time to think about how he fit into the situation at that point in his life. And he, at that point in his life, was ready to become vocal and active. Being Arthur, he had to pick his time. He wasn't going to do it because somebody else said you need to do it. He had to do it his way.
Well, then he did. And he got pretty active in the anti-apartheid movement for South Africa. He called for boycotts. He demanded that the stadium get desegregated before he would play there. I mean, it was pretty controversial. How much of an impact do you think he ended up making?
I think it was, to a large degree, a great impact. He spent more time in the ghettos of South Africa than he did on the tennis court. You know, he allowed and wanted the young South Africans to see what a free black man looked like. He wanted them to see the possibilities. And when you think about it, that's what Arthur has always represented, the possibilities of life.
I'm speaking with Johnny Ash, a brother to the late tennis legend Arthur Ash. There is a new film out about his life. Johnny, I want to ask you about another important chapter of your brother's story. It was, of course, his battle with AIDS after a blood transfusion in the 1980s. He tried very, very hard to keep it private. What do you remember about the early days after he got sick? I mean, what was his outlook on the diagnosis?
To a degree, it was devastating because at that point, we didn't really know a whole lot about it. He knew his time in life would be cut short. But what that actually did, it caused Arthur to quicken the pace to do the things that he had thought he might want to do. You know, he got involved with the Heart Association and, of course, the Foundation on AIDS. And then he got more involved with lecturing kids and other things. But it just accelerated, you know, his timeline for life.
What was that like for you? This was your big brother, you know, the guy who you did an extra tour in Vietnam for.
I'm not going to say it devastated me because I always held out hope for them having found a cure in time for him. But by the same token, I realized that, you know, I was in a situation where I had to hold on to the possibilities and, you know, help him in any way that I could during this period. And basically that's what I did, you know, because the very, very few people knew, you know, he told that he did, daddy didn't know before he died.
Why? I mean, why not tell your dad?
Well, daddy had already had heart problems. And I think Arthur believed that that would just increase the worry and anxiety that he had had all his life.
And there was the stigma of AIDS.
Well, yeah, but the stigma that Arthur was worried about for Jeannie and Cameron,
his wife and daughter.
I don't think it was a matter of stigma as far as daddy was concerned. Okay. And the reason I said that is because, you know, there was no question in our minds or in Arthur's mind whether he was heterosexual or not. And that's where a lot of the stigma came from.
I want to listen to what I think might have been his last public statement. This is from the Connecticut Forum in 1993.
There is still a tremendous amount of work to be done with the public to assure them that ordinary contact with people like myself poses absolutely no danger to them. I can sneeze in their presence. I can cough in their presence. We can drink out of the same glass. We can use the same knife, fork, or spoon. We can kiss, and you're not going to transmit the virus.
It's amazing to listen to that and remember what it was like in the late 1980s and the early 1990s when AIDS was little understood. But what kind of responsibility do you think your brother felt to then become almost an AIDS activist after all that?
Well, I think the answer to that question is the simple fact that if you think about Arthur's life, he became an activist from the time he won his first tennis tournament in Richmond, Virginia, from the time he went to UCLA and won the indoors and won the NCAA. Arthur's life was quiet activism, because what does an activist do? Activists try to influence people, okay, and I hope they do it for the right reasons. But Arthur, living the life that he lived, was pure activism without him saying a word.
Johnny Ash, it has been a pleasure talking to you about your brother. The new film, it's called Citizen Ash. It's about the life and activism of the great tennis player Arthur Ashe. Thank you so much for your time.
Very welcome.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
On this final day of November, the Atlantic hurricane season officially ends, and it was a busy one. 2021 was the third most active season on record. The most memorable storm, of course, Hurricane Ida. The sound of Ida coming ashore in New Orleans. It made landfall in Louisiana as a Category 4 storm in August on the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. It flooded entire communities and ripped off roofs before causing even more destruction in the Northeast. Megan Borowski is a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network, and she joins us now. Hey, Megan.
Hi, Peter.
So, first of all, Ida killed more than 90 people and caused nearly $65 billion in damage. When we look back on this season, where do you think Ida will rank in the history of destructive storms?
So, in terms of cost of destruction, Ida is already number 5. It's on that list. It's just above Irma, just below Sandy. $64.5 billion in damage. So it's definitely going to live in the record books as a strong and destructive storm. I do want to note that we mentioned it made landfall on the 16th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, and this storm actually made landfall stronger than Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana was a high-end Category 3. Ida was a high-end Category 4 when it made landfall.
Well, rightly so. Ida got a lot of the headlines, but there were actually 21 named storms this year, which is above normal. What else was noteworthy about the season?
Oh, gosh, there are plenty of noteworthy events. First of all, we had Elsa was the earliest named 5th storm of the year, and that made landfall as a tropical storm in the Florida Panhandle in July. Something else, another storm that I thought was quite interesting was Hurricane Larry, and that made landfall as a Category 1 hurricane in Newfoundland. So we do have a high latitude hurricanes every now and again, But the last one to make landfall in that high of latitude was Maria in 2011.
Mm. The season, you know, we're looking back on it, it was really busy up until September, and then it kind of trailed off into October, and especially by November, by the end, there was almost nothing. Is that normal? Did that surprise you?
I was looking at the frequency of the storms being named, and it pretty much followed the climatological curve of ramping up toward the beginning of July and August. I was a bit surprised, though, that we trailed off in October and November, especially because we went from El Nino neutral to a La Nina, and typically La Ninas help to enhance hurricane activity. So we'll be looking into that, to why it trailed off early on.
Okay, and we know that these storms that we've been talking about, they've been growing stronger and faster, in part because the climate is changing, the oceans are heating up. When we look ahead to next year's hurricane season, mm-hmm. do these factors make it more difficult to figure out what might happen?
Well, of course, you know, you've got to weigh which impacts are going to reign supreme, you know, in next season. But it looks like we'll be looking at La Nina positive, so that could ramp up activity next season. We'll keep an eye out, and we'll keep you guys posted, of course.
And we'll have you back on. Megan Borowski, a meteorologist with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Megan, have a quiet and restful winter season.
Thank you.
CNN host Chris Cuomo is under scrutiny again for trying to help his brother, former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Documents released by New York Attorney General Letitia James show Chris Cuomo used his media contacts to dig into those who accused Andrew Cuomo of sexual misconduct, allegations which eventually led to the governor's resignation. And now CNN says it's conducting a thorough review of the new evidence, meaning the future of the primetime host may once again be in jeopardy. For more, we're joined by CNN's, or rather from NPR's own, David Folkenflik. David, refresh us a bit. Because these allegations really stem back to the charges against Andrew Cuomo. So what is he facing right now?
Well, he's facing accusations from, you know, half dozen women, say, of unwanted touching, of unwanted, seemingly to them, sexual advances, some physical contact, some of them seemingly sexual harassment, all of them feeling deeply uncomfortable in the presence of the chief executive of the state of New York. He, of course, was forced to resign under intense public and political pressure and is now facing in Albany County, New York, a criminal complaint that was filed. The prosecutors have questioned whether or not the way in which the charges were filed will hold up, and so they're sort of revisiting that. But nonetheless, Cuomo has some legal jeopardy there and, of course, potential civil suits as well.
Okay, so that's what Andrew Cuomo is dealing with. But his brother Chris is back in the spotlight because, well, really, you could say this is the second time, because in May, it was the first time that we learned he had been an advisor to Andrew Cuomo, and CNN at that point declined to discipline him for his close ties to his brother. Chris said he wouldn't do it anymore, but now we've got these new documents from the attorney general. So what do they show, and is this even a deeper involvement that's going to become a problem for him?
Right. So two batches of documents. One was his testimony. The other showed his sort of real-time texting and emails back and forth with the governor's top aides and inner circle. You know, CNN had indicated Chris Cuomo had indicated that he had participated in conference calls, essentially, and been listening in and offered a little advice here and there. He was actively and aggressively texting the governor's top aide to be tougher. He was advising, for example, that the governor cite cancel culture as what was occurring to him from perhaps more liberal members of his own party, the Democratic Party. He was strategizing. He was going to try to seek out what other reporters might have on accusations against his governor, his brother, the governor, really taking a fairly aerobic, fairly muscular role in his defense, not simply as a brother, but as a strategist, essentially doing both research, messaging, and in some ways trying to exert discipline over the governor's top aides.
But Chris Cuomo, David, is trying to make a distinction. He's saying he was seeking information about what other accusations might be coming out of the woodwork, but that he wasn't doing oppo research to disparage his brother's accusers. Do the documents bear that out?
Well, there's one line in which he says, I think I have stuff on the woman from the wedding. There was a woman at a wedding reception who said the governor had sexually harassed her. And, you know, he may call it research or just, you know, what any reporter might do. But it certainly looks as though he's trying to get whatever information he can to cast her credibility in bad light, although he, from my reading of the documents, doesn't use that exact phrasing to present it. I've got to say, Cuomo is denied doing anything wrong. Andrew Cuomo has said, basically, I misunderstood the context of things. He denies doing some things wrong here. But I think it looks as though Cuomo's characterization back in May doesn't hold up.
Okay, big picture here, David. I mean, we can look at Chris Cuomo's individual actions, but the network also has to take a look in the mirror, doesn't it? I mean, they've benefited for years from Chris Cuomo's access to powerful figures. He's, of course, from a powerful political family. This is the son of Mario Cuomo, after all. But now they're saying, we don't like how close you were to your brother. I mean, is this a broader challenge to its credibility as a network?
It would be a lot easier for CNN to address this publicly if they didn't sort of bathe the public in the fraternal love fest that occurred in the early weeks and months of the pandemic, presenting not just this jocular diversion as an entertainment to the public, but also Andrew Cuomo as an exemplar of great governance. It turns out that even that is under strong scrutiny. There have been reviews done of what happened at nursing homes across the state of New York in the early times of the pandemic as a result of the governor's and state policies. And I think CNN has been compromised by this. They have come to review these things, as they say now, very grudgingly. And I think that's only because these things are now public, as opposed to on their own initiative, taking the effort to make sure that they were keeping faith transparently with the public that they say they're serving as a major news organization.
All right. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Thanks, David.
You bet.
There is a tiny spotted reptile called the bog turtle trying to hold on to its very existence along parts of the eastern United States. The turtle is a federally threatened species, but in Massachusetts, it's on the endangered list. Conservationists there have worked for decades to protect its shrinking habitat and to stop poaching, and it looks like they're making progress. Hannah Shenatry of member station WBUR went out to see for herself.
To find a bog turtle, you first need a good pair of boots. You're going to get shin deep in the mud.
I'm good. Just a little stuck.
We're moving slowly, following Angela Saroy Patel through a network of tiny streams.
I think we're getting pretty close.
She's following a radio signal that tells us a turtle is nearby. Many of them have small radio tags attached to their shells.
Pretty much we follow the signal and then we dig until we find one.
Saroy Patel works for the Nature Conservancy. She's been keeping an eye on these turtles for more than 15 years. They aren't believed to be a keystone species, meaning their removal is not likely to cause the ecosystem to collapse. But they are important to maintaining the state's biodiversity, especially as a native species. They're thought to have existed in the state as far back as the Ice Age. Saroy Patel feels a certain responsibility to make sure they don't go extinct.
I think it's just important to give them the space and to give a lot of other wildlife and species the space to live and persist because they have that right too.
After a few minutes of walking, she crouches down and sticks her hand underneath a mound of grass and mud.
It's right there.
She comes up with a turtle. He's smaller than a cell phone with bright orange spots.
This is male 135, and you can actually see, like, he has some of these beautiful starburst patterns on his shell. He's actually pretty active. Now he's sticking his head out, trying to climb out of my hands and get back in the water.
Bog turtles are one of the smallest turtles in the world. Because they're cute and rare, people poach them to sell as pets, which is why we have to keep this location secret.
It's arguably one of the most imperiled species in the state. It's dwindled to fewer than 100 individuals.
Mike Jones is the state's official herpetologist. He coordinates conservation programs for reptiles and amphibians. He says what makes the turtles so vulnerable, in addition to the turtle napping, is their fragile habitat. Bog turtles only live in certain shallow wetlands with very specific chemistry. Over the past 2 years, human activity destroyed those areas.
The wetlands they live in are easily drained, they're easily filled, they're easily impounded. So the bog turtle was probably always rare in Massachusetts, but now is really in a precarious state.
The Nature Conservancy has spent the past several decades restoring the wetlands to meet bog turtle specifications. Now they're working to keep it that way. Saroy Patel spends her days clearing out shrubs and trees, removing the occasional beaver dam, and keeping a close eye on nearby construction projects.
you know, the challenging part here is that, like, you want the location of the turtles to be secret, but you also want projects that could impact them to be mindful and not screw things up.
What's harder to protect against is climate change.
We're seeing different species show up in terms of newer invasive plants that maybe are more, you know, can handle this climate, or they can are more suitable to those like erratic weather patterns that will become, you know, more invasive in these areas.
Climate change could also bring different rain and flood patterns that can make the wetlands too wet or too dry for the bog turtles. Mike Jones says the turtles' decades-long lifespans mean they respond more slowly to big changes.
We'll only know as the years play out, but it's very likely that climate change will affect all turtle conservation in the Northeast.
So far, the habitat management seems to be working. Jones says even though the population is fragile, he thinks it's heading towards recovery.
I really hope that the bog turtle, you know, makes it another 50 or 100 years, but it is very hard to see that far out. You have to do your part in the moment.
Saroy Patel says she's seeing promising signs in the wetlands. On our field trip, she found a bunch of turtles, including one that hasn't been spotted in 10 years and is now a healthy adult. For Here and Now, I'm Hannah Schnatchery.
The musician Beverly Glenn Copeland has been honored at New York's Guggenheim Museum this year. It's a recognition that was a long time coming. Copeland's music crossed a number of genres in the 1970s and 80s, but then he spent decades out of the limelight. Now he's the subject of a documentary and a forthcoming tribute album. Many of his fans are quite a bit younger than the 77-year-old artist, who was black and transgender, and as Allison McCabe reports, they're drawn to more than just his music.
Beverly Glenn Copeland, or Glenn as he's known to friends, compares himself to a radio that's tuned to pick up certain frequencies. His father was a pianist. His mother sang spirituals. At 17, Copeland left Philadelphia to study classical music in Montreal. He released two folk-inflected albums in the early 1970s. Both went unnoticed.
Look into my eyes, the color of any heart. This season needs you now.
Soon after, Copeland moved to the woods and started creating music for children's television. Then he got his hands on an Atari computer and a drum machine. In the new documentary, Keyboard Fantasies, he describes the experience as transformative.
Suddenly, for the first time in my life, I had access to wild sounds that a piano couldn't make, that a traditional acoustic instrument couldn't make. Plus, I had access to things that almost sounded like a violin if you squinted really hard with your ears.
In 1986, Copeland self-released a cassette album called Keyboard Fantasies, selling only a few dozen copies. But over the next three decades, his music quietly circulated around the world.
Welcome to spring, the summer rain. Softly turn to sing again.
British filmmaker Posy Dixon says she first heard it in 2017.
I can remember like so clearly the sound of Glenn's voice and just being like, wow, who is this? What is this music? And I also remember thinking like, I have no idea whether this is somebody from contemporary times, if this is somebody from the 70s, if this is a man, if this is a woman.
Dixon started searching online for more of his music, eventually finding Copeland himself. As their friendship deepened, Copeland realized the best way to connect with his audience was to meet them. Even though he hadn't been on stage for years, drummer Bianca Palmer says the first time she saw Copeland, she was awed.
That music is like so much of his own acceptance of himself and just like an incredible listening and relation to his body and the world and nature itself.
In the intervening years, the universe brought him challenges, but also possibilities. Palmer says it was clear he was there to share more than just his music.
He just thanked our generation for just caring about this world. Everyone was just dripping with tears.
After the show, Copeland came out to see Palmer play with her own band, then invited her to form a touring ensemble, which he dubbed Indigo Rising.
Deep river,
My home is over Jordan.
Posey Dixon filmed Copeland and Indigo Rising performing together for the documentary Keyboard Fantasies, The Beverly Glenn Copeland Story, now streaming on demand. She says she isn't simply sharing a story about discovering an overlooked talent, but a figure who is in many ways transcendent.
Glenn's story has got so many elements of it connect with so many people. His position as an elder, as a queer elder, as a queer elder of color, who is living this like rich, beautiful, calm, successful life, is such a powerful vision.
Although Copeland has gained a significant following, cellist and sound artist Kelsey Liu says his legacy is only beginning to be realized.
There is this, this feeling of love that I think we all as fans really feel. And I also think that we don't have as many elders to look up to in that way. Somebody that has been unapologetically themselves through time and been able to exist and survive and thrive.
Along with the electronic musician Asma Maarouf and filmmaker Wu Song, Liu honored Copeland with a collaborative installation at New York's Guggenheim Museum this past summer. Now Liu is among the contributors to Keyboard Fantasies Reimagined, an album that builds on Copeland's boundless soundscapes.
Welcome to you, both young and old. We are ever new. We are ever new.
Health issues preclude Copeland from joining us, but last year he told NPR's Ari Shapiro he's grateful young people are embracing his music and message, though he humbly claims he's only the medium for these cosmic transmissions.
It's good to know that the music that's being sent to me at this point is making a difference for folks in one way or another.
For NPR News, I'm Allison McCabe.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Callum Borchers in Boston.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now.